is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. Election overtime and divided government. 1 month after the midterm elections, we have a better idea of the magnitude of the Democratic sweep, at least in the lower chamber of Congress or House of Representatives. After all the votes were counted, the Democrats gained at least 40 seats, giving them a larger margin of victory than originally anticipated. A veritable blue wave, say some analysts. Republicans, on the other hand, returned to power in the Senate with a fortified majority of 53 seats. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. What will this new balance of power beginning in January 2019 mean for the remainder of U.S. President Donald Trump's term? How will recent developments in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russia's interference in the 2016 elections and potential ties with members of the Trump campaign affect the presidency and our democracy? In recent days, President Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, admitted to lying to Congress about a vital timeline regarding a Trump real estate deal in Russia. And the special counsel recommended that Mr. Trump's former national security advisor, Michael Flynn, serve no prison time, citing his, quote, substantial assistance with several ongoing investigations. Flynn was forced out of his post in February 2017 after serving less than 1 month after the White House said he misled administration officials about his contact with Russia's ambassador to Washington at that time. He is one of five Trump aides who have pleaded guilty in the special counsel probe. With us to analyze the implications of a democratically controlled House of Representatives and examine the implications of the new revelations in the Russia probe are our two veteran political analysts. John Fortier is a political scientist and director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler is senior vice president for policy at Third Way. And both regulars join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
John Fortier, let me start with you. Because since, of course, the midterms, we have different results, as I alluded to in the introduction. What kind of a difference do these numbers make? And also the geography. Talk about the types of people who brought the Democrats into the majority and what that means.
Well, Democrats had a very strong midterm result with winning 40 to 41 seats in the House, picking up 6 to 7 governorships, 300 or so state legislative seats out in the country in the various state legislatures. There was a small counter move in the Senate where Republicans picked up a couple seats, especially in red-leaning states, and so the Senate will remain in Republican hands. I think the big move was there was a very high turnout, and the big move was for educated suburban voters to send a message against Donald Trump. The seats that Democrats picked up were mostly in these kinds of suburbs, but sometimes suburbs we didn't usually think of Democrats representing, in Oklahoma City, in Houston and Dallas, places broadly across the country, but also in the South, which is a Republican area. This is partly some indication of realigning voters in America, where Donald Trump has done much better among white working class voters and is struggling among more educated voters. But it's also a trend that has been going on even before Donald Trump. But partly it is the normal midterm result of a president at 43% job approval rating going into a midterm where midterms go against the party in power and Democrats doing quite well. So it was a very good day for Democrats and just a few bright spots for Republicans in the Senate.
So to you, Jim Kessler, if the story in 2016 was enthusiasm for Trump, and particularly in rural and small-town America, the story for 2018 is this revolt led by females, particularly, and educated voters and the suburban voters who turned against Mr. Trump and really gave a victory to the Democrats, for the House of Representatives at least.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And this was a bad election for Donald Trump. There was one bright spot in the Senate. Republicans picked up a couple of seats. The 40 House gain by Democrats was, as you noted, it exceeded expectations. And there were also governor's races. Democrats picked up 7 governor's races. This is what I think is most worrying if you're Donald Trump. Donald Trump won the presidency because he won in 3 places where Democrats had always won since 1992, and that was Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. He won those 3 states by a combined total of about 100,000 votes, won them all by just a hair. But 3 moderate Democratic governors won those states this time around. two of them flipped the state from Republican to Democrat. And those three Democrats won by a total of 1.1 million votes. So this, what's called the blue wall that had crumbled when Donald Trump won in 2016, it might have just been re-erected this time. And also Democrats won in Arizona with Kyrsten Sinema. She was a moderate. She won a Senate seat there. That's another state that could possibly flip in 2020 from a Trump state to a Democratic state. So I think there's ramifications for 2020 in this election that is good for Democrats and bad for Republicans.
And also, the Democrats picked up a Senate seat in Nevada, also considered more of a Republican stronghold.
So that is a state that 8 years ago you'd say that's a red state, and now it's purplish to blue. This is becoming a more diverse state. A lot of Latino voters have moved in there. There's also a fairly large African-American population. And this is a state that Hillary Clinton won in 2016 and is trending in the blue direction, the way Colorado has become a bluer state as well.
All right. So another trend line we see with hindsight, John Fortier, is that the Democrats have won over the so-called Rust Belt states like Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, which went for Trump in 2016, at least for now. So let's take a look at the Republicans. Other analysts are saying, too, that the more Republican states, we call them red states, have become more red, and the blue states have turned bluer. Are we really much more divided, would you say, rural, urban, and, you know, other types of divides are you seeing in the electorate?
Well, I do think Donald Trump has pushed forward some trends we've been seeing for quite a long time. I have a slight dispute about the Midwest here, where I do think Democrats did quite well in those states. But I think the Midwest is still going to be the battleground going forward. There were some good results for Republicans. Republicans doing very well in Ohio. I would say, you know, Wisconsin was quite close. There were places where they retained the state legislatures. So, look, I think going forward, this was a good election for Democrats. But you may find that the Midwest is still the battleground. You know, as for what Republicans are doing, they're winning more in white working class districts. I look at the state of Minnesota, an interesting place where they actually gained a couple of House seats in very rural and Rust Belt type districts, and then also lost two seats in suburban districts. It was a microcosm of the kind of trends we've been seeing in the country the last 10, 20 years.
A quick follow-up. What does the Republican Party stand for now? Some analysts have said, have noted that in the aftermath of this election, there's not been a lot of soul searching about, you know, why they lost. It's really Trump's party now. How do you see that? What does the Republican Party stand for? Because some of the values or principles that they stood for, free trade and other principles other than, you know, a certain conservatism vis-a-vis the judiciary, it looks like they're no longer undergirding the party. It's really Mr. Trump's party.
Look, after an election, some presidents come out more directly. I think Bill Clinton did this and said, look, I'm going to change direction. I think Barack Obama more or less came out and said, yes, we lost, but kept on the same course. Donald Trump hasn't really admitted defeat in this, and I think he sees the direction that he's going, the Republican Party going, as still viable. Both parties are big tent parties. So the Republican Party is still a party that has business interests and small government interests, but they have moved to be more connected to kind of populism, a kind of economic populism, certainly on trade, on immigration. The people who lost, and this is often true in midterm elections, are the more moderate members of the Republican Party. The remaining caucus will be more solidly skeptical about immigration as the president is. So there's tensions in the Republican Party, as there are in the Democratic Party, and there will be a bit between business-type conservatives and those who are the interest of the white working class voters who will be more skeptical of immigration and to some extent trade. But that doesn't mean that that's still not a viable coalition that could come back in 2020. Many presidents have lost the midterm elections, and some of this is the moment of the midterm going in one direction. Some of it is long-term trends, and Donald Trump is not destined to lose in 2020. We'll have to see what the conditions look like at that time.
How do you see it, Jim Kessler? We haven't seen much soul-searching, and some analysts are saying it's really Mr. Trump's party, which is a betrayal, some would argue, of the principles that the Republicans have stood for, whether it's free trade, not as rigid, perhaps, a position on immigration, that really what are left now, particularly in the House of Representatives, are very diehard conservatives, and it doesn't really represent a bigger tent, as John alluded to.
If you're going to do soul searching, you need a soul. I'm not so sure he really has one, at least politically, on this. I think he's out for himself more than out for the country. At the same time, I think the Republican Party has become a nationalist party. We've seen nationalist movements in Europe as well. It's also a populist party. I think populism and nationalism often go together. And I think that it is, through Donald Trump, it is becoming a more dangerous party. That's not to say that all the voters are, quote unquote, deplorables, as Hillary Clinton said, but I think Donald Trump is leading the Republican Party in a bad and dangerous direction. We just had the funeral of George H.W. Bush. That was a noble party. You know, during my entire adult lifetime, I opposed the Republican Party, but always saw them as a noble, patriotic party. I think Republicans are now a nationalist party. Donald Trump can win in 2020. It depends on a couple of things. Obviously, what happens with world events and the economy. It's up to Democrats to nominate the right type of person who can win. You have to realize that there was a lot of economic pain in this country to elect Donald Trump in the first place. I think that pain still exists out there despite the good broad numbers in America. And one of the things that I find most heartening about 2018 is there is a divide in the Democratic Party as well. There is a populist left led by Bernie Sanders and a lot of his allies, and there is a more moderate Democratic center. That center won in primary races across the country, and especially in, I agree with John, what's going to be the battleground states in the Midwest. If Democrats nominate somebody from the Bernie Sanders wing of the party, Donald Trump, assuming he is not taken down by the Mueller investigation, Donald Trump will be president in 2021. I guarantee it. Democrats have to nominate someone that can appeal to a broad range of the country. Bernie Sanders and his agenda, I just don't think can do it.
Before we go to a break, I want to get John Fortier's comments about the passing of our 41st president, because Jim read my mind when he mentioned George H.W. Bush, in a sense, in contrast to our current president and what the party appears to stand for today. How will his legacy be remembered?
Well, I think we've really got a sense with the commemoration of the dignity of George H.W. Bush. He was somebody who really, more than others, stood above politics in a sense of his character. There was a lot of support on both sides of the aisle for the man who he was, and he led us through a very turbulent time, both with the end of the Cold War, certainly in the first Gulf War. I will add, though, that President Bush lost his election. He won one term, and I do think his son, who won two terms, is still someone who parts of the Republican Party at the end of his term were unhappy with. And so these are important figures. They serve their country well. But Donald Trump partly ran against George W. Bush and his foreign policy and advocated a course for, you know, more cautious use of force in building democracy around the world that appealed to some of his base. I do think that George H.W. Bush should be honored, but I don't think that he's going to be the model politically for Republicans going forward. He is somebody who represents something of an older era.
Indeed, he's a true internationalist, in contrast to what Jim said about the direction of the party becoming much more nationalist. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are John Fortier, director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler. He's senior vice president for policy at Third Way. We're analyzing the electoral and political ramifications of the U.S. midterm elections as more races have been called and results begin to sink in. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a big friendly shout out to loyal listener Isaiah Pere Edwe Preye. He's from Asaba in Delta State, Nigeria. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion of the U.S. political landscape. John Fortier, let's take a look at the Democrats. Jim alluded to some divisions. We see a Democratic centrist trend as a result of the midterm elections. Lots of former veterans, many female veterans, one of whom we actually interviewed. Elaine Lourdia won her seat in Virginia. Nonetheless, there's a division, and we just saw Nancy Pelosi, who was the, how would we call her?
She was the minority, or is the minority leader in the House.
She's the minority leader, and she was, of course, the punching bag, I guess is the word I'm looking for, from the part of the Republicans. You know, this person who can be used to rally voters to vote against the Democrats and vote for Republicans. She's also a point of contention within the Democratic Party. Nonetheless, it looks like she will be the speaker. And let's talk about the implications for that.
You know, will she be grooming a younger group? There are many in the party, particularly among the more centrist Democrats, that are really anxious for new leadership. How do you see her, ability to rally the troops and bring forth the Democratic agenda in the coming Congress?
I think Nancy Pelosi is a very experienced leader, and I think it's smart for Democrats to bring her in as Speaker. Part of the controversy comes from the fact that Nancy Pelosi, as well as the number two and three people in leadership in the Democratic House, are 78 and 79 years old, have been there for a long time. There was some hope that there would be new voices. I think she's going to survive this challenge and become Speaker in January as Democrats take over. But there was certainly pressure for her to think about the future. She didn't have to concede as much as I think some people thought she might have to, but there's a young African-American leader, Hakeem Jeffries, who's been perhaps groomed to be a successor, put in a lower leadership position. There is a question still how long this leadership team will last. I don't think we'll ever go to the number two and three people as Speaker. If Nancy Pelosi leaves, I think we'll see a more wide-open move to a much younger generation. Some of that is a political difference, but I think most of it is because Nancy Pelosi is broadly pretty progressive but has knitted together her coalition in the House. But I do think that there is some hunger for somebody who would be more diverse, younger, and perhaps, you know, more openly progressive in at least some parts of the caucus.
So, Jim, you have your finger on the pulse of the Democrats. How do you see this split, this internal battle for leadership in the party? Was it the thought that Nancy is so experienced, and of course she's definitely in line for being Speaker, but there's this concern about the future of the party and the need to groom leaders if they want to govern in the long run?
Right. So I think the difference in the House for the Democrats, it's a little bit more generational than ideological. You know, I come from the wing of the party, the centrist wing of the party, that is not supposed to like Nancy Pelosi because she is a progressive. I'm a Nancy Pelosi fan. When the far left of the party is becoming too vocal and is promoting ideas that can be harmful for Democrats, she's the one that is strong enough and has their trust enough to put on the brakes there. She makes sure that moderate and centrist voices are heard. She does a very, very good job as Speaker. There is a next generation that, you know, is eager to step in. I agree with John. I think Hakeem Jeffries, African-American from the outer boroughs of New York City, he could be the next Democratic Speaker. He is a very impressive person, brilliant, and he's progressive, but he's not overly so.
Let's turn to how the Democrats will exercise their oversight role now that they're in the majority in the House of Representatives and at the same time try to advance some positive legislation. How do you see that, John Fortier, particularly in light of so many revelations now in the so-called Russia probe that are pointing more toward potential conspiracy, we don't know yet, between perhaps members of the Trump campaign and Russia? We're coming to a pivot point, and the Democrats are anxious, and perhaps rightly so, to bring to light through subpoena power and their oversight authority that they'll have in the new Congress. How do you see them striking this balance?
Well, first, investigation. I mean, that is a power of Congress. Congress is supposed to oversee the executive branch. You mentioned the Mueller investigation, the one most people have on their minds. They will certainly try to keep that alive, literally the Mueller investigation, as well as dig deeper into these issues in their committee oversight. But I think they'll do this more broadly across the different departments that the Trump administration runs and that they are on the other side of many issues. And look, it is the function of Congress to do that, and they will be able to highlight some issues and make it uncomfortable for Donald Trump. I think they will also certainly pass through the House of Representatives, bills that are representative of Democratic values. Their first bill will be about democracy issues and improving democracy. I think those will be relatively partisan bill, won't get traction, won't get done. And then at the same time, I think they'll do some things in healthcare that'll be somewhat like that. But at the same time, there are some possibilities. And even the president and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have sat down a bit and talked about things like infrastructure or prescription drug pricing. There is some opportunity for key moments of bipartisanship. We shouldn't expect that this is going to be one big bipartisan love fest, but there are a couple of issues that perhaps a Democratic House and a Republican Senate and a Republican president can get together and work on.
So, Jim Kessler, can Democrats chew gum and walk at the same time, as we say? Because no question about it, there's going to be much more oversight now that they're in the majority. They have subpoena power. They can conduct investigations. Some analysts say that while the Republicans were in the majority, many issues were simply ignored some of the conflicts of interest, and then, of course, all of the investigation into Russia's interference. What do you expect to occur as the Democrats take power in terms of both oversight as well as potential legislation?
So Republicans really abdicated their oversight role when they had majorities in the House during the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And if it was a Democratic administration and a Democratic House, there would have been far more oversight. Yes, there's a difference when you're the same party rules Congress, but I've never seen anything like this where a party just completely abdicated their responsibility on oversight. So you're going to see Democrats investigating heavily. Will they be able to also pass legislation that gets to the president's desk? Will they be able to make bipartisan deals? The jury is really out on this. There have been some halting moves in the past. As John noted, Chuck and Nancy in a room with Trump, they came to a deal on immigration that was scuttled 24 hours later, frankly, by Trump's staff. So is there a chance for this to happen again? I'd say more than a tiny chance, but I wouldn't say it's greater than a 50% chance. To me, the smart move for Trump would be to try and do it because it increases his chance of getting reelected and having people say, like, okay, the first 2 years he was kind of off the rails, but with a divided Congress, he was able to cut deals. But I've been wrong on his ability to sort of read those tea leaves before. He just doesn't seem to get it. He doesn't seem to be able to actually cut a deal.
Before we close quickly on the Mueller probe, John Fortier, some analysts are saying we're coming to a pivot point. We're seeing Michael Cohen having lied to Congress and the implications of that. Michael Flynn speaking with the Mueller team approximately 19 times, all kinds of revelations that he may be providing. How do you see this, and what are the implications, do you think, for the Trump presidency going forward?
Well, I think the first thing to be said is that we really don't know what the Mueller investigation is going to do. There's a lot of reason to speculate. The Mueller investigation has some indications that it looks like it may be trying to wrap up and move to whatever that conclusion is. Some are reading this as there may be some more indictments, but maybe it won't go really directly to the president, and it will be more of a report which lays out many embarrassing things and even points to potential criminality or violations of various norms and laws that would be out there and not good for the president. But we're not sure. And I do think whatever happens, it's not going to be a good thing for the Trump administration. It's not going to be a positive report if it's only a report. But again, I do think we've seen presidents have significant investigations which have caused them some trouble, and it hasn't necessarily brought them down. Of course, we have the extreme case of Watergate where a president had to resign. We have other cases like Iran-Contra with Reagan and Bill Clinton with the independent counsel who had significant political difficulty because of the results of those investigations and yet moved on and were able to govern. So I expect it's going to be a set of bad news. I still think the odds that it goes to the heart of the presidency is probably not that great. But I suspect in the next 6 months we will have the kind of news that will be nearly final for that investigation.
And so you get the last word, Jim Kessler, combined with the Democratic oversight in the House of Representatives and the pivot point we seem to be at with the Mueller probe. How do you see this going forward in the implications for President Trump?
Mueller doesn't leak anything. So John is right. We don't know. He's like a hermetically sealed petri dish. But you look at what just happened with his recommendations with Michael Flynn and saying that he deserves no prison time because how much he's cooperated in this probe. I think it's pointing to a lot of bad news for the Trump administration. When the Mueller investigation is complete, will it be enough to remove Donald Trump from office? I think with previous presidents, it definitely would be. But Donald Trump is a different animal. And what caused Richard Nixon to resign, if Donald Trump was Richard Nixon, he probably would have waited it out somehow, not for the benefit of the country, but for the benefit of him.
We will be at these microphones next year talking about this and many other issues. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, Director of the Democracy Project at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Senior Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Gentlemen, as always, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Misha Dubinsky. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.